we're going to carry on looking at that passage this evening. And I've got a question, actually, to start off this evening is, on what basis would you call yourself holy? On what basis would you call yourself holy? It's not the kind of question we might ask down the pub or kind of talk maybe, but it's a really important question. It's important because it's a question that God asks us. On what basis do you call yourselves holy this evening? You see, God, revealed in the Bible, is a holy God. He is completely set apart from us in his beauty and his majesty and his purity, his transcendence. He's completely separate from the creation as the creator. And everything that's associated with God is holy too. He is holy in his word. His law is holy. His deeds are holy. They're described in the Bible. Even his wrath or his anger is holy, we read in the Bible. And we do also read that his people are holy. So I ask you again this evening, on what basis are you holy this evening? God is holy and his people are called to be holy. Are we holy? Actually, it's quite an important question, isn't it, when we think of it like that. God called his people in the Old Testament, and he called them his holy people. He gave them his law. He revealed his character in his law so that they could act according to his character. They were set apart to enjoy a special relationship with their God. And they had a special role to deliver to the nations around them. They were set apart for these things. And God gave them his moral and spiritual law to follow and to reflect. But on top of that, he also gave them what we could call ceremonial laws. These included food laws. There were lists of animals that they could eat and animals that they could not eat. There were foods that they could and couldn't eat. Some were called clean and some were called unclean. And it's concerning these foods linked to the ceremonial law that Peter has a vision about here in Acts chapter 10. And you can imagine he has this vision. God reveals to him all of these unclean animals pass before him, and is horrid to Peter. Peter's shocked by them, and God calls to him and said, "Peter, get up, kill, and eat." Well, Peter won't hear anything of it. I've never done anything of the sort of thought, says Peter. "I will not do that. That is unholy. I can't eat what is unclean. That is unholy. Holiness prevents me from doing that." And so God has to confront Peter and says, "No, you can eat these things." He doesn't rebuke him by saying, "Peter, what utter nonsense. Don't be so narrow-minded. Come on, have a bacon sandwich." No, he does rebuke him, but he rebukes him on these terms. He says, "Peter, don't call unclean what I have called clean." Oh, so it would seem that God is calling what he used to call unclean, he's now calling clean. He's changing. He's removing the prohibition to eat it. He's now saying it's okay to eat all foods. This seems a little, in fact, Jesus has already said it's okay to eat all foods. No food is unclean. You can read this in Mark chapter 7, verses 18 to 23. Jesus says this. He says, "Whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him. It can't make him unclean, just what you're eating, since it goes not into his heart, but into his stomach, and then is expelled. Thus he declared all foods clean." So Jesus is saying that actually never has any food actually made somebody unclean. It doesn't do that. It only goes to your stomach and then goes out of the body. But what makes people unclean, unholy, is what comes out of the heart, Jesus was saying. So would you just bear with me for a moment? Because this does beg another question, doesn't it? If If the food itself never actually made someone unclean, then why ever did God ever call it unclean in the first place, we might ask? Well, let's go back to that situation in the Old Testament. God's people, God's called out to be his people, to be a holy people, to enjoy him and to reflect him to the nations. Paul tells us that Israel at this time were being treated by God a little bit like we might treat a young child. You know, when we have children, young children, we want to care and look after them, to protect them from the dangers that are around them. We say things like, we're wrapping them up in cotton wool. We want to do everything we can to protect them from dangers until they're old enough to act for themselves. Well, in the Old Testament, God was doing a bit like that to his people. He was lovingly protecting them from the corruption of the nations and safeguarding them to enjoy this special relationship with himself. And so he makes a wall around them. He puts this wall of ceremonial laws, of unclean foods and things around them so that they would remember how easy sin pollutes us. They were confronted every day as they had to be cleansed from being unclean. But more than that, just bear with me before we carry on. You know, Israel could literally not go to tea with the nations. These food laws prevented Israel from going and eating with the nations around them. They couldn't mix or socialize with the other nations because they didn't eat the same foods. And so in this way, God was protecting and safeguarding his people. But sadly, we find out that Israel abused these laws. You could imagine, couldn't you, if you had this wall of ceremonial washing and eating certain things, to begin with, Israel started to feel rather superior to the other nations. Intrinsically, they felt much better than they. But they were not, were they? They were not intrinsically better than the other nations. And it brought confusion. Israel started to mix up you had the moral, spiritual laws. They were to love God with all of their heart, soul, and strength, and their neighbours themselves. And instead of doing that, they put that to one side and they concentrated on these food laws and the ceremonial laws. And they were very good at that. And they concentrated so hard at the externals, and they laid to rest the heart of the law, the heart of holiness. And you know, by the time it came to Jesus' day, the religious leaders, would you believe it or not, Jesus looks at them and he says, you are like white. You're white on the outside. You're working so hard at all these purification things on the outside, but on the inside, you're utterly dead. You have no moral or spiritual holiness to speak of whatsoever. It's all a big show. And so you can imagine, can't you, that for Cornelius here, there might have been some kind of resentment towards the Jews. Cornelius was an upright, good-living, praying Gentile. He was giving his money away to the poor, and he was seeking good. And then he looked on at the Jewish leaders, and they were corrupt, and they had shady business deals, and they were acting unjustly, and they were oppressing and downtreading the poor. And yet, alongside all of that, they would view people like us as unfit to eat with. You could imagine Cornelius probably felt a little bit of resentment towards the Jews. The holier-than-thou attitude that they gave away as they could not eat with Gentiles because of all these ceremonial laws, you know. And so there was a problem. The gospel had to go to the nations, and these ceremonial laws were getting in the way. The pursuit of holiness was actually hampering the spread of the gospel. In Jesus, as he comes to earth, God to man, God was going to start treating his people now as grown-up sons. This wall was going to be removed. The food laws were the first things to go. Yes, Israel was not to act in the same way any longer. And so we've got Peter here, and God is speaking to him, rebuking him, saying that he's repealing the food laws, and that there is nothing unclean any longer that you are to eat. And then as soon as that happens, he has a knock at the door, and there are these Gentile friends from Cornelius's house, and they say, Peter, you must come to Cornelius. He's had a vision. Come. And Peter is thinking about it all and weighing it all up, and he's trying to work it out. And you know, Jesus is teaching Peter, even now, years after he first called him to leave his boat and to follow him, again and again, the call comes, Peter, you must come and follow me. I think Peter had been trying to deal with the changes. Jesus had called all food clean, and he had said to preach the gospel to the nations. And we find Peter staying with Simon the tanner. That's not a normal place for a Jew to be staying, is it? But he was trying, wasn't he? But that wasn't enough. God doesn't just kind of tweak around at the fringes of our lives. No, he needs to change us completely. It's not a case of what difference does Jesus make to my life. It's how does my life fit in with the plans of God? And when you put it that way, you know, the whole of your life has to change if you're going to follow Jesus. You have to think about his big picture. And if he's prompting you to serve in a certain way, or giving you gifts to serve him, or opening doors for you to act in a certain way in service for him, and we're saying, no, no, no. He's saying, follow me. Even this evening, he may be prompting you to act or do some kind of ministry for him. Come, follow me. A radical change of obedience if you're a Christian. And so Peter gets up, and he does indeed follow Jesus. He goes with these friends of Cornelius, and he travels to Cornelius's house, and before long, he's in a rather awkward situation. You see, Peter is there with his few Jewish friends, and they're in a room, and across the other side of the room is a whole host of Gentiles. I think maybe we can relate to this a little bit in today's context. There was a severe social distancing problem, I think we could call it, couldn't we? There was a sense of tension in the room. No one quite knows how to act, because Jews did not mix with Gentiles in this way. And Cornelius was a centurion, a Roman soldier. Never would these two come together in a house like this. How awkward it must have felt. And yet this was God's plan. And Peter was following God's command. And Cornelius explains how God has been leading, and how an angel of God came and told him that he'd heard his prayers and seen his acts of his good deeds, giving to the poor. And how, in fact, if you turn to Acts chapter 11, verse 14, how there was a man called Peter who was going to come and explain the way of salvation. And so we called for you, Peter, and here you are, and we're dying to hear what you've got to say. And so all the Gentiles sit back and they listen to what Peter is going to say. Boy, Peter's got to open his mouth. You know, a few years ago, you'd wonder what on earth he'd say. But see, the reed has become a rock. Look at Peter now. You know, back then when Jesus had said those words to Peter, Peter had no idea of what was ahead. Maybe he dreamt of some kind of nationalistic freedom. But here is Peter leading the way of the gospel coming to the Gentiles, of the spread of the gospel having eternal fruit, eternal freedom for the world. And here is Peter, the rock, about to bring it to Cornelius and his household. I suppose we could call it the Gentile Pentecost. So Peter does indeed open his mouth. And the question hangs in the air at this point before we just momentarily look at his sermon. The question is, well, so if the ceremonial and the food laws are being removed, how ever can we be holy? Is God going to replace these standards? How is he going to declare us holy? Has the world got better? Well, it hasn't got better. Has God's standards got less? Well, no. In Jesus, we find that the standards, if anything, are so much higher. Jesus talks about how it's not just the action that holiness is, but it's the motive. It was not just don't murder, but don't hate in your heart. It's not just doing a whole load of things, but it's about loving God with all of your heart, soul, and strength, and loving your neighbor as yourself with your very being. This is the standard of holiness. How can we be holy? Everyone in the room is begging to hear the answer. And so Peter answers the question, and the answer is really quite straightforward. The basis of Christian holiness is found in Jesus. It's in Jesus that we find the basis of Christian holiness. And three things that we see about Jesus that brings holiness to his church. And the three things are, firstly, Jesus is the bringer of peace. Peter begins his sermon in verse 36 with just this: as for the word that he sent to Israel, preaching good news of peace through Jesus Christ, he is Lord of all. And then in verse 43, he ends his sermon with Jesus, the bringer of peace. To him, all the prophets bear witness that everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins through his name. Peace. Peace with God and peace between people. This is what Jesus brings. It's peace. For the Jew, well, they'd been searching for peace. The law had been pointing to peace, but in and of itself, it could not bring peace. And Cornelius, well, he was looking for peace, and he was praying to God, and he was giving his money to the poor and seeking good wherever he could give it. And yet he did not have peace. For the Jew and the Gentile alike, we can look to religion, or we can look to our good works and compare ourselves to other people. And yet neither will find peace with God, because peace with God only comes through Jesus, the bringer of peace. To the Jew, Jesus brings your peace. To the Gentile, Jesus brings your peace. This is for all people, we will find out. It was for the Ethiopian eunuch, do you remember? That flying in the high echelons of society, peace through Jesus was for him. And it's for the, I suppose we could call them the lowlifes, the Philippian jailer, peace through Jesus for you. It's for the rich businesswomen like Lydia, who found her peace in Jesus. It's for the demon-possessed slave girl, peace through Jesus. It doesn't matter what age you are or what gender you are. It doesn't matter what nationality you are, what religious heritage you've had. We only find our peace with Jesus. It doesn't. Peter has already told us in verse 28 that it's not by virtue of your nationality that you can be declared clean before God. The Jew is not clean on the basis of being born a Jew. And for the Gentile, it's not on the basis of being a Gentile that he can be declared unclean. No, we're on common ground before Jesus, and only he can bring our peace. Only he can forgive our sin. We can't cover it with a religion or with our good works, our sin. Our sin is forgiven in Jesus. But not only do we find peace with God, but through Jesus, we find peace between us. Peter hints at this in verse 36, that Jesus is Lord of all, of the Jew and the Gentile alike. Peter says in Ephesians chapter 2 that in Jesus we find that he is our peace. He has destroyed the dividing wall of hostility between Jew and Gentile. If you went to the temple, you'd literally find a wall that would separate the Jew from the Gentile. There was this real sense of division through their life. But in Jesus, Peter says, that wall can be knocked down. There's no longer two people. There's no longer a subclass of Gentiles and an upper class of Jew. There is one class of people. Together we have sin. Neither of us can deal with our sin. And together we find peace in Jesus Christ. Firstly, then, what's the basis of Christian holiness? Jesus, the bringer of peace. Secondly, what's the basis of Christian holiness? Jesus, the supreme doer of good. Cornelius was a man who sincerely sought to do good and help the poor. And actually, this is something that unites Jew and Gentile again. It doesn't matter what nationality you come from, what heritage you have, what gender you are. If you genuinely seek good and you love goodness, then come and admire Jesus, Peter says. Come and look for a moment at Jesus. Jesus is the supremely good person who's ever lived on this earth. Peter says, I can bear witness of this fact. In verse 38 to 39, I witnessed it with my own eyes, Peter says. Come and look as he heals the sick, regardless of how tired and exhausted he is. He would be healing after healing. He would look on the crowd with compassion and love as they were thronging around him. He's the supreme doer of good. He feeds the hungry. He casts out the demon-possessed. He's the supreme doer of good. And this morning we thought of how even when he was led like a lamb to the slaughter, he did not open his mouth for cursing. He's the supreme doer of good. And even as they put nails in his hands and his feet, the supreme doer of good offers forgiveness to the very people who were crucifying him. Come and admire the goodness of Jesus this evening, Peter says. And then comes the bombshell in verse 39. We had one last week, didn't we? You've got the supreme goodness of Jesus, but they put him to death by hanging him on a tree. Here, Peter hangs his head in the room. The Gentiles are looking on with open mouths as Peter hangs his head and says, my people, the Jews, they killed him. They killed the supreme doer of good. And they didn't just kill him, but they killed him by hanging him on a tree. The punishment, the sentence reserved for the very worst and vilest of criminals. The curse that was brought from hanging someone on a tree. They killed Jesus in this manner. You say, how could the human heart be capable of such a thing? How could the religious mind be so perverse as to treat the very cleanest of human beings who's ever walked on this earth, and to treat him as the most unclean and vile criminal and hang him on a tree? However could this happen? What has privilege bought the Jews? Where has the better than thou attitude? What has that achieved for them? We have here utter bankruptcy of religion. Their good works are woefully falling short as they reject and crucify the supreme doer of good. But then we have to ask ourselves the question, is the Gentile any better? Well, at that thought, Cornelius and his friends at the other side of the room, they too would hang their heads in shame, because we all know that although we didn't literally put the nails through Jesus' hands and feet, any Christian can say, it was my sin that took him to the cross. We know the depths of our heart. We can try and cover up our sin with the good deeds of what we're doing. We can do this and do that and give and make a show. And yet all the while, however we're trying to cover up the depths of our heart, you know, we all stand shoulder to shoulder, condemned at the cross of Jesus. There's a verse in the Bible that says, he bore our sins in his body on the tree. That verse is a commentary on the reality of the sinful nature of every human heart. No one is superior than the other. There is no room for boasting or standoffishness at the cross. This evening, we stand before Jesus, the supreme doer of good, equally sinful, equally feeling condemned. But it doesn't end there in Peter's sermon. Verse 40, God continues to act. He raises Jesus from the dead. Peter says, I've eaten with him and drank with him. He came back from the dead. He's alive. This Jesus of Nazareth, the Lord of all, the supreme doer of good, is alive. And what is more than that, in verse 41, I think it is, verse 42, what is more than that, Jesus of Nazareth, the Lord of all, the supreme doer of good, is the judge of all the living and the dead. One day Peter says, and he looks around the room at this point, everyone's heads hanging low. He looks at his Jewish friends who, knowingly, they'd rejected and crucified their Messiah. He looks across at the Gentile friends across the room, and they too know that their sin is there and they have no peace with God. All heads hung low, Peter pronounces, Jesus is the judge of all the living and the dead. One day we will all stand before him. That's you and me this evening, friends, too. And the thing is that Jesus, God become man, walked amongst us on this earth. And he, the judge, sets the standard. He shows us his goodness as he lives his life on this earth, faultless, completely pure. The standard is perfection. He never sought his own will, but only the Father's will. He loved God with all of his heart, soul, and strength. He did indeed love his neighbor as himself, faultless, completely holy. And he is the judge. And as we stand before him one day, there is no room for the Gentile to rail back and answer back and say, but I am better than you. Because they look at the standard of the supreme doer of good, the judge, who is going to cast the verdict. And the Jew cannot answer back, but I feel superior, because the Jew knows that they rejected and crucified the supreme doer of good. And so it would seem that all is lost and all are condemned together at the foot of the cross. But that isn't how the sermon ends. Peter joyfully shares, and the room is shocked as the verdict is revealed, that the judge of all the living and the dead, who is the supreme doer of good, who is the Lord of all, can offer forgiveness. He can offer forgiveness. This is the basis of Christian holiness. It's not covering up with religion or masking up with good works. It's coming shoulder to shoulder together, looking down in humility, the dust of the ground at the foot of the cross, knowing equally that there's nothing to boast about in and of ourselves, coming empty-handed, and finding with joyful shock that the judge offers as a free gift his gift of forgiveness. There it is. Nothing to boast of, and yet everything to rejoice in together at the foot of the cross. And then in this room, the Holy Spirit is poured out, God's power enabling these Gentile believers to be declared holy in God's sight, and then to have a power to live a holy life, something that that Judaism never knew anything about. This is the basis of holiness I give you this evening. And you know, as we finish this evening, we're going to sing in a moment, but as we finish, here we find our one body, the church, unified in the Lord Jesus Christ. You know, amongst us, there should be a reflection of everybody, nationalities, different stratas of society, different ages, men and women, children together, bound together in Jesus. That is where the trajectory of history is traveling, everything united together under Christ. And as we come out from lockdown, and together we have to rethink how we can do church together. What does community look like now as we grapple with all of these questions? When we have to cover our faces and unable to sing together and we struggle. And we'll all have different opinions about what is right and what is wrong and different preferences. And we like this and you like that. And, you know, very easy amongst the body, how easy it would be for us to erect walls between ourselves. Walls that Jesus gave his life to remove, to take away, to unify and bring together under Christ. So this evening, I'd urge us together to look above the struggles and the disagreements and the difficulties of joining together, and together to look at the Lord Jesus Christ, the perfect and spotless righteousness, the one who gave himself for us so that we together, Jew and Gentile from every nation together, may be declared holy before a holy God.